It feels like a marriage that's gone wrong. They feel to me like an ex-spouse now. They lost my house and they forced me to live in another county sort of thing. I've got a new love now and she treats me really well.
The Premier League, as it stands and how it's marketed and how it's now run, it's not for me. This is for me. FC United is for me.
The only reason that there are still 92 clubs in the top four divisions is because of fans. Fans have stepped in and saved so many clubs. And I think in the future, in 5 years' time, there'll be another group of clubs. But once again, the fans will be there to say, we're going to save it.
Hello and welcome to Who Are You, a podcast about the football clubs of Great Britain. Every month we travel to a different football club and find out about the issues affecting them. Over the course of this podcast, we will attempt to discover what really matters to fans, placing their stories in a broader footballing context. We'll go to any club at any level in the men's and women's games. Before we get started on this episode, there's something we'd like you to know. We've been nominated for a British Podcast Award in the Sports Podcast category. By the time you listen to this, we may or may not have won, but we are absolutely thrilled, whatever happens, to have been nominated alongside some well-established sports podcasts, and we're massively grateful for your support and feedback so far. Despite the inevitable fame and riches that have greeted us since this nomination, we are still massively grateful for any publicity you can give us, from spreading the word on social media to those ever-important iTunes reviews. So, if you like what we do and can help us out, please do. For this episode, we've changed up the format a bit. Rather than hop on a plane, train or automobile to any one specific club, we are instead asking the fans of Great Britain's protest clubs, who are you? If Who Are You has taught us anything so far, it's that there's a lot of disillusionment with the state of modern football. Our very first episode looked at a club brought to its knees and the fans taking action to oppose those doing it harm. Wherever you look around the English game, there are stories of clubs being mismanaged or mistreated, some to the point of near ruin. Whether it's by fat cat property developers in Dulwich or megalomaniac owners in the Northwest, for many clubs, their future is not about what happens on the pitch, but trying to ensure they have a future at all. It is against this backdrop that some groups of fans take the ultimate step of defiance, forming their own club. These are the protest clubs. First off, a clarification on what we mean by protest club. We'll be using a definition provided to us by the ever-reliable Wikipedia. It's a club created out of either fans, players, or club shareholders protesting the way the original club was treated or run. So that means that Phoenix clubs, clubs that rise from the ashes of now-defunct teams, need not apply in this episode. We'll get to them one day. For this episode, rather than focusing on one club, we're speaking to fans of FC United of Manchester, AFC Liverpool and 1874 Northwich, as well as a bumper interview with a protest club expert. These are clubs with varied stories, each probably deserving of their own episode, but united by an element of protest that was essential in their formation. To get a handle on what it means to be a protest club, we found a man who literally wrote a book on fan ownership in football.
I am Jim Keoghan. I'm a lifelong Evertonian, but I've also got an interest in supporter ownership and fan activism. So I'm the author of a book called Punk Football, which looks at the history of fan activism in this country and how supporters have morphed from customers to stakeholders.
So what is punk football exactly?
It takes the kind of the DIY aesthetic from the kind of the punk movements of the 70s. So the idea is that for years, I think fans felt that it was only local businessmen who could run clubs and be chairman. I think during the 90s, this new idea came in that why can't we do it ourselves? And since that idea has arrived, you've had a blossoming of supporter-owned clubs and also trusts who gain a stake at clubs. So the idea that we are just customers and we can't do this, I think, is gone now, really.
When people think about protest clubs, the famous example of AFC Wimbledon is probably the first one that comes to mind. But, like most protest clubs, it's difficult to categorise them. You might think of the London club as a protest club, defying the move to Milton Keynes, a Phoenix side, rising from the ashes of Wimbledon FC, or simply the same club that it was when the crazy gang won the cup. It was their story, whatever they are, that caught Jim's attention.
It's one of the worst things to happen in English football, maybe in the last 30 years. I mean, for fans to have their club just taken from them and moved like 70 miles further north is a disgrace. And I was so kind of impressed by what happened next to say that, right, fine, we're going to start our own club, and for so many fans to get behind it, and for that club to then do well and get back into the Football League and reach the point now we're in the same division as the club that kind of left them. I thought that was really impressive. So I wrote about that initially. And then from that, I explored more into the story and kind of how this, what was really a revolution in what it means to be a fan in this country, kind of how it happened and what's happened and what can happen in the future. For about maybe 100 years in this country, football was quite benign. Fans were quite happy to see themselves as customers because football was simple. It was cheap to get in, and it was cheap to compete. So owners didn't gamble too much. They were just local fellas, often motivated by a love of the game or civic pride. There was no kind of angst within the game. I mean, there were moments. Clubs did occasionally have trouble, and you know, managers and chairman could be unpopular, but it wasn't like it is today. I think the change comes in kind of two forms. You have a change within football, so that benign environment disappears. So with the arrival of the Premier League, you get ticket prices rising, you get much more money coming into the game, so it becomes more expensive to compete. You get a different kind of owner coming in who are often more willing to gamble, both local people and people from outside the community. And you get the sense that the game is moving away from the fans, and a sense that fans are being disenfranchised. Alongside that, you get a more political fan emerging anyway. So you get the fanzine movement emerging in the 80s. You get anti-racism campaigns at certain football clubs. So you get these twin factors happening, and then they unify with the idea of fan ownership, which first emerged in 1992.
Out in the Manchester suburb of Moston, the early April sun beats down on Broadhurst Park. Only 13 years on from their formation, FC United are preparing to host Darlington. Darlington were in the Football League when their hosts today began their rise up the leagues. But a familiar sad tale of owner neglect means that the Phoenix club, Darlington, have likewise had to climb the divisions and are now battling FC United in the National League North.
I'm George Baker, I'm the board member responsible for communications and season tickets and memberships.
George told me about some of the reasons behind FC United's formation.
10 years previous to the Glazer takeover, there'd been an announcement in Old Trafford for fans that all fans must remain seated throughout the duration of the game. It's only a few years after the Taylor report. And this kind of was a culmination for a lot of fans of just the amount of sanitation that football was going through. They kind of got fed up with just not being able to enjoy football the way they used to be able to enjoy it. And the Independent Man United Supporters Association was formed as a result, which is a supporter-run pressure group, which campaigned to get Manchester United to appeal more to the match-going fan. And there's all kinds of issues, just, you know, being priced out of the stadium, the lack of atmosphere, the constant policing, not just at home games but away games, overzealous stewarding. Manchester United started catering more to the day tripper than it did to the season ticket holder. They wanted people filling the stadium who could maximise their revenue with merchandise sales, and most football fans go to the game, might have a beer and get a pie or whatever, but Manchester United fell out of love with those kind of fans. We wanted the club to listen to us more, and the only way we could get a control of that United was through Shareholders United, which was the fan collective which aimed to buy as many shares in United as possible so that we could have a stake in the club. And when the Glazers came along, bought it outright, not just bought it, but in the hostile manner that they did it, with, you know, so much leverage, that was the final straw for many, because we knew that there was no chance we would ever be able to control the club that we love, even partially.
Home and away fans are soaking up the rare Manchester sun, and we see who's about for a chat. We think we know what to expect from FC United fans. They're surely all Manx who go to Broadhurst Park for the terracing, camaraderie, cheap ticket prices, and that all-important local connection.
My name is Philip and my father is Paul.
Philip and Paul told me about how their love for FC United flourished.
Because we supported the small clubs and the fan-based clubs. In Germany, it's against commercial and standing places, terraces. In 2006, where the Glazer problems, where we have looked in football magazines in Germany, and there were a lot of articles in the football magazines for fans.
Yeah.
So we followed by the internet sometimes and see that there is built a new stadium a few years ago. And so when my father 60 birthday, and it was a present, and that was the first trip here 3 years ago, and in the last year we were here, and today the third one, and we love it very much. Yeah.
It's easy to stereotype fans of protest clubs, but it's obvious within minutes that FC United is followed by people from all backgrounds and from all walks of life. It's not just Manchester United fans looking for a cheaper day out than Old Trafford. Also outside the stadium is Baz. He's selling the first ever edition of a new FC United of Manchester fanzine, Top of the World. It was a fantastic read, sharp, witty and informative of the current situation here in Mostyn. Well in, lads, good luck to you. But anyway, it was a fanzine, Red Issue, that first mooted the idea of FC United. So it feels appropriate that at this club in particular, there's one being sold.
First issue of the new fanzine for FC United, yeah.
Can we talk to you about it?
Well, basically we're a club that started off essentially from a fanzine, Red Issue, and we found ourselves without one for a number of years, and that doesn't seem right. We've got a very active fan culture. News happens on like a very extreme basis. Right, Des?
One of the many people buying a copy of Top of the World is Des Gallagher.
Just spend all my time in bloody meetings. Just come off.
How's the DF one?
It went all right. Okay. We've got plenty of stuff, plenty of things to be focusing on.
Oh yeah, that's good.
People just need to understand that.
Yeah.
You know, it's no use throwing your dummy out of the pram just because the finances are so poor.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
You have to carry on.
That's
otherwise,
for sure.
I'll be at B&Q next summer on a Saturday afternoon, and that's not going to happen. Des Gallagher, founder member from 2005. And I'm now on the development fund committee of the club, which helps raise club monies for club funds to continue the development of the club, be that physical development or financial, emotional, social development, community work and that sort of stuff. Staying in this division this year is really important because dropping out will mean we could lose up to £50,000 worth of sponsorship. We can't afford to do that. The club's on a knife edge financially, and we have to take every chance we've got to stay in this league.
Moving inside the ground, FC United is a fantastic football experience. The St Mary's Road end is a cacophony of noise and would surely delight those in search of an old school footballing throwback. It's a welcoming, passionate atmosphere. Although FC United fall 2-1 to the visitors, the crowd go away having had a genuinely good time. While some FC fans may still look out for results from Old Trafford, this new club of theirs has grabbed a hold on their footballing hearts.
I'm a Manchester United supporter born and bred. I'll always be a Manchester United supporter. But Manchester United as it is now is not the Manchester United that I grew up with and supported. Manchester United Football Club as it is now is a corporate behemoth that is far removed from the Manchester United Football Club that I supported. That's the way of the world. I don't miss Premier League football. Old Trafford has changed completely. Football, as it's run today by the people who run it, it's always entertainment, but it's more like a night at the opera or a night at the theatre. The soul has gone out of English football at Premier League level, I think. United have tried very hard to get kids back in, you know, so like £15 tickets in the front of the Stretford End this year for next season for kids. Kids can come here for £2. All right, they're not going to see Sanchez and they're not going to see Lukaku or Pogba, but they're going to see players out there really, really pulling their tripe out trying to play football. The Premier League, as it stands and how it's marketed and how it's now run, it's not for me. This is for me. FC United is for me.
And what are the future hopes for FC United?
We survive on the field and off the field. Got to stay in this league, and we have major financial challenges. Well, certainly in the next 12 months, and then indefinitely in the next 5 years, we have major financial challenges that face us because of this ground. It's a great ground. It looks a great ground, right? But there's a lot of things that have gone financially wrong with the build, and those financial chickens are coming home to roost in the next 2 to 5 years. So we've got to survive that. If we survive that, we'll fly away, because we are beginning now to operate at a profit. once we get the ground build debt off our backs, if we ever do, if we do get it off our backs, we'll be a different club.
There's no club like FC United, I don't think. I mean, yes, there's plenty of supporter owned clubs, but this is a club which was born out of ideology, it was born out of protest, it was born out of passion. And it's something that we never thought none of us would ever have. You know, as much as the vast majority of us still love Manchester United, we know that it's a long way away from, it's out of reach. Whereas here, we feel like because this is ours, it gives you, and because we have a say, because we control it, it just feels that extra special. And the atmosphere that we can create, and the camaraderie we've got, and the friends we've made as well. I knew nobody. I literally knew nobody when I went to FC's first ever game, and now I know hundreds of people. I'm on first name terms with hundreds of people. I've made some of the best friends I've ever made. Just that collectivity and that unity, it's absolutely fantastic, and I'd recommend it to any Manchester United fan or any football fan who approves of supporter ownership.
Across the M62, AFC Liverpool have themselves been fighting their way up the lower tiers of the North West Football Leagues. They were set up as an alternative for fans who felt priced out by the game at the highest level. So how does one go about setting up a protest club? It can't be as simple as getting a group of well-meaning folk together, buying a football and asking if you can play, can it? That's exactly what I asked Alan.
Hi, my name's Alan Parry. I was the founder of AFC Liverpool, so I came up with the initial idea, was its first chair, and I'm currently its honorary life president.
Alan told me about setting up the protest club.
All these things kind of combined together where I thought what we really need is that community of people who used to go to the game on a Saturday at 3 o'clock need a football club. And that's where AFC Liverpool came about from. The actual start was really easy. I remember my partner came home, my partner at the time, and I said to her, I've just set up a football club. And she laughed at me, obviously. I thought, I'm going to build a website because then it's real. And on the website, it's simply going to have a description of the idea and a little box so that people can put their name and email address in order to join the list and find out more information. And just waited to see what happened. And there was a huge take-up of people filling in and joining my email list. What happened after that became ridiculously hard. We had absolutely nothing. We didn't really have any non-league experience of running a football club. We didn't have a manager. We had no players. We didn't have a kit. We didn't have a badge. Crucially, we didn't have a ground. Unless we could find some way of getting a ground, we wouldn't even be allowed into the league anyway, so we had to come up with ground sharing agreements. It was just like a ridiculous workload. I was doing like 16-hour days easily. The worst thing was, I mean, I'm a musician and I put my music career to one side basically, but I had this international festival that I was doing. While I was in Denmark, I got news from the other people at the club that the FA had actually turned down our application to the league. I had to put together a dossier to try and overturn the FA, and I didn't have much hope of that. I had to put a case as to why AFC Liverpool were a special case. They relented and said, okay. It was fantastic to see this thing which didn't exist at all, you know, just a couple of months prior. Didn't have a manager, no backroom staff, not a single player. And we'd gone through trials and manager interviews, and we were ending up on this pitch on this day. It was pretty wonderful. And to think it was all owned by the supporters as well. It's having its 10th year anniversary this year. So it's 10 years since it started. It's won silverware. It's been promoted. And it's still going, you know. And I think any business that starts up with a whole bunch of people who are totally inexperienced, if it's still going in 10 years, even that's a testament, never mind the silverware that they've won.
It needs a massive amount of goodwill amongst the supporters. I think more than anything, if you haven't got that, then you're doomed, because you're asking them to put their hands in the pocket every single season. You need volunteers. I think something was there. Exeter City almost totally reliant on volunteers on a match day. It's volunteers on the gates, it's volunteers on the to get a pint of the pie. There's volunteers selling programs. It's these clubs aren't really running as a business because they haven't got the money. If you haven't got that amount of goodwill, then you'll fail. And as you talked about earlier, then you need also the supporters just on board in general, even those who aren't volunteering, even those who aren't members of the trust, you need them to believe that this model can work. You need them to kind of temper what they want from a season. Then you need people on the board who are willing to put in the work, because it's, you know, it can be a thankless job. You're putting in loads of hours, you know, sometimes not getting paid, and you're doing it all for a fan base who sometimes won't be kind of completely behind you. So it's, without those three things, you're doomed.
Also in the Hallmark Security League are 1874 Northwich, a protest club protesting against Northwich Victoria. Maybe not as high profile as Manchester United or Wimbledon, but the fans were not happy with their club, and many of them decided enough was enough. Filling us in on the 1874 situation, Chris Borley.
With a group of former Northwich Victoria fans, the decision was made on the 15th of November 2012 at an extraordinary general meeting of the Supporters Trust by 141 votes to 4 to form the new club. I actually stopped following what they were doing after that point. As a club, we were a protest. People call us a protest club, but we're not a protest club. We just had enough of being run by a complete bunch of no-hopers, really. I think the main thing is for us to cut our cloth accordingly and prove to everyone that we're a well-run club, which we are. We've got a lot of friends now in non-league football. We seem to be getting better relations with all our neighbours year on year. We do an awful lot of work for charity. We've got good relationships with St Luke's Hospice at Winsford. We're trying to get a bit of pride back for the green part of our town.
1874 find themselves in the same league as Northwich Victoria. They've never lost to them after a handful of games and will this season finish above them. But how do fans deal with seeing their ex so frequently?
They are still going. They're actually playing in our league. I think we're about 10 points ahead of them in the league. I have more love now for 1874 than I ever had for Northwich Vicks. My first game at the Drillfield was in 1974 when I was 9 years old on a really rainy, horrible day against Gould Town, 0-0. I was there in 78 when we beat Watford in the third round of the FA Cup, sat my dad's shoulders behind at the terminus end. All three Wembley finals that Vicks got to. So no one can say I wasn't a Vicks supporter. I look back now at that time. It feels like a marriage that's gone wrong. They feel to me like an ex-spouse now. They lost my house and they forced me to live in another county sort of thing. And I've got a new love now and she treats me really well.
The things that force the creation of each individual protest club are different on a case-by-case basis. But there is a universal theme of dissatisfaction with the way authorities, owners and generally people with money currently treat its lifeblood. Us, the fans.
The main thing is probably money, really. I think there's so much money that's come into the game that it's changed what it means to compete. And I think you get people come in and often with good intentions who will gamble and spend a lot and then realise that it's not that easy and then suddenly maybe lose interest or they just can't cope with it and the club gets into debt and it spirals downwards. You get owners come in who probably shouldn't be owning football clubs. Overall, you've got probably football authorities who aren't that bothered if there's a few bad clubs in their system. As long as the overall product looks good. So the Premier League aren't interested in what happens to the fans. The Football League aren't really that bothered. And the FA certainly aren't bothered. So you've got this environment where you can't care where someone comes in, overspends, and then loses interest. I think that happened with Orient. It happens elsewhere. Or you get people who just are incompetent. And the problem is the football authorities then don't intervene. So these clubs are a mess. And there's plenty of clubs knocking around now, like Coventry and Blackpool and Orient, who are in an absolute mess. There's no help from the football authorities at all. So who's going to step in and fix things? It's only going to be the fans.
So a protest club is born. Then what? Does football then become totally okay forever? It's something of a childish rhetorical. But the romantic idea of a fan-owned club isn't necessarily one that's tied to success. Recently, AFC Wimbledon finished above Milton Keynes Dons for the first time ever. But they're not going to win the FA Cup again anytime soon. And even making the second tier of English football would be a monumental achievement. So how does a protest club progress?
Early on, when a club is fan-owned, people are very on board. Often there's been a financial crisis beforehand. So when the fans take over, they say, well, let's do things properly. Let's live within our means. But as time goes on and the memory fades, football fans naturally want upper progression. They want their club to finish as high as possible. I was talking to somebody involved in Wimbledon and they were saying that their model as it stands probably can't get beyond League One. Mm-hmm. So if they manage to stay in that league and are competing and doing well, then there's going to be a generation of fans coming through who are going to say, well, why can't we get further? Why can't we just bring in outside investments? And then you have that kind of that clash between those who recall the problems of the past and want to keep the purity of the model and those who want to just get money and spend. So they're always facing that problem and the simple problem of just having enough money to compete. I think Wimbledon have one of the lowest budgets in League One. I mean, it's very hard for them to do what they want to do at that level.
And back with Baz setting top of the world.
There you go, ta.
Cheers, mate, ta.
Nice one. Unfortunately, I know a lot of people are frustrated at the football. I think we've just got to accept we're going to be mid-table for a while because we can't. We heard from the AGM that I think it's Salford, Harrogate or Brackley. Their budgets are like six times ours. We're not going to compete with that. We can't compete with that. Unfortunately, we wish we had money to plug into that, but we've got to pay off loans first before we can even start financing the football team and the players.
And George Baker, in the stands of what on the surface seems like the perfect home for FC United.
First and foremost, we need to get this ground finished. It may look finished, but you know, there's both ends of the main stand need completing. The stand behind the goal, St Mary's Road, and that's undergoing some renovation later on in the year. Not only that, but we've funded this ground through community shares and various loan stock initiatives, and we need to pay all of that back. We can't get ahead of ourselves by contributing too much to the playing budget, because again, that's not what we're about. A lot of the clubs focus too much on going up the leagues as fast as they can, whereas FC, we want to maintain a sustainable football club that's affordable for its fans and the local community. We're not out to change the world. We're not out to tell clubs how to run things. Clubs like Fylde and Salford and everyone, they're doing their thing, we're doing ours, and we're proud that we're supporter owned, and there are limits to how far we can go based on the principles that we have. I don't see it as a sad thing. I see it as, that is just football, you know. A lot of fans of football clubs want to see their team successful, and that's perfectly okay. Here at FC, you know, we're the same. We want to see our teams win as many games as possible, but at the same time, it's more important to us to keep the principles of the club and what we're about.
While they may not be out to change the world, I wonder if protest clubs represent a changing attitude in football fan bases. Are dissatisfied football fans now more likely to take up arms and build a club that represents them, rather than just waiting for their club to change?
There are maybe a strata of fans that are definitely political that wouldn't have been the case 20 years ago. And they're always activists and they're always protesting. But that, I think the majority of fans, no. I think the majority just, they're probably armchair fans, or they not even, you know, say something like the Premier League, not even in this country. You think of a club like Man United, probably more, the people have got more fans abroad maybe than they have in this country now, because they're such a big global brand. So you're dealing with kind of, you're not just dealing with what happens in the Premier League in England, you're thinking about what happens in South Korea or America or something like that. So we've had a revolution in what it means to be a fan, but it's only really affected parts of the kind of national fan base. And they are very active, but you can't really confuse that for everyone suddenly becoming more activist.
But at the same time, are we in danger of over-romanticising these protest clubs? Although built on the hard work and inspiring fortitude of volunteers and the most passionate football fans you're ever likely to meet, these clubs are far from perfect.
I mean, I think it's great that they exist. I think it's good that you've got an alternative out there to the kind of the old-fashioned model of ownership, because if it was just one model and you had no kind of recourse or something else, I think it'd be a lot of clubs would have gone out of business, a lot of clubs would be very different than they are now. I think most fans don't get involved in football to run a club. You go just to watch because you love the game and you want to watch the game. So I think inevitably you're going to get people who, you know, might initially be interested then lose interest, or you can't be bothered going to this, can't be bothered going to that. And equally, you've had examples of fan-owned clubs who really messed up. I think Notts County came in and they were given a huge part of the kind of the shareholding by somebody and they had the club, and then they sold up to some Middle Eastern consortium, and the club nearly went bust again. So they're not perfect. I think in my book, I think I had like three or four examples of where they really messed up. Fans can cock up just as much as owners can. It's not a perfect model. And equally, those who get involved are not always going to be perfect either. They can get bored, they can make mistakes. It's not ideal, but it is great that it does exist.
And to finish us up, I asked Jim about his favourite thing from writing a brilliant book about protest clubs.
I was just so impressed by the people that you came across, because I couldn't do it. I couldn't do what they've done. I haven't got the energy to do what they do. But, I mean, people like the Portsmouth fans, I mean, they've been through hell, and you wouldn't blame them for walking away, and yet they still do this. And Wimbledon too. I mean, to go from, I think when the club moved to Milton Keynes, they were in the Championship. To go from experiencing the Championship or recent Premier League football to going down to the Southern Counties League and still loving your club and still getting involved and doing this and still putting the hours, it's just amazing. It's just, I mean, there's so many stories of people who'd, you know, not kind of raised money on Saturdays, gone around different grounds and protested and put in so much energy and time beyond what you'd expect for a normal football fan. You couldn't fail to be moved by them, and the sense of just how much they love these clubs. They were kind of, and how much, and also how much these clubs matter to that community. I think that often gets forgotten, that football clubs don't exist in a kind of an island. They're rooted in the community and kind of businesses and people and memories and pubs and that kind of stuff. And it's you get kind of, when the clubs are in crisis, you get that sense in the people who respond, and you kind of, you realise just how much this matters and how important. I mean, people say it's just a game. I mean, it's clearly much more than that to these people and to everyone who gets involved in football. It's obviously much more than just 90 minutes. It's a way of life, and it's I kind of, their stories really kind of impressed me, really moved me at times as well.
Protest clubs represent football's best and football's worst. The fact these clubs exist is a depressing reminder that the bonds that unite us to the beautiful game can be broken. Our clubs can hurt us. Our sports can hurt us, sometimes irrecoverably. Yet these clubs are built by fans who refuse to be victimised by their beautiful, ugly game. Whatever the future of these clubs, and who knows yet if more clubs like them will appear in the future, it is clubs like these that represent where football is at the moment. As the money in football builds and builds, we have no idea if it will reach a saturation point at any time soon. But the richer players, agents and owners get, the more some fans become detached from the modern game. And the wealth disparity between the haves and the have-nots leaves some craving something a lot more real from their football. As we've heard, protest clubs are far from perfectly run and may not be the complete escape from the game's ills. But football would do well to heed the words of these fans to ensure that the game doesn't suffocate itself. Jock Steen once said, "Football without fans is nothing." And these fans prove him right. Thank you for listening to this episode of Who Are You? A reminder once again, if you like what you hear, we'd love you to tell everyone you know about us. And I mean everyone. Either via iTunes review, social media, or good old-fashioned real life. If you have any feedback, questions, or want to suggest a club we cover in future, you can tweet us at WhoAreYouPod or email WhoAreYouPodcast@gmail.com. And now we're also on Instagram, so follow us at WhoAreYouPod as well. Thank you to Jim Keoghan, George Baker, Baz from Top of the World, Chris Borley, Des Gallagher, Philip and Paul from Germany, and everyone else who assisted in the creation of this episode. This episode, as always, was a co-production by myself, Ben Cartwright, and David Cowlishaw. If you want to stalk us on social media, we're BAJ Cartwright and David Cowlishaw. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.